Fatherless Fanny by Anonymous. Chapter 26. A Father. One night, when Fanny was retiring to rest, she found a sealed note upon her toilette, superscribed to herself. Surprise and something like fear seized her mind, as with trembling hands she broke the seal of this mysterious address. For mysterious it must appear that a note should be left upon her dressing-table, in a place where she knew nobody beyond the walls of the house she inhabited. On opening the paper, she found it was from Mr. Hamilton. It contained the following words: "I have kept my word, and am now an inhabitant of the house that contains you. This assertion startles you, no doubt. But, when we meet, I will explain the mystery to your satisfaction. I have now no doubts remaining respecting who you are. Neither will you, when you hear the wonders I have to relate to you. Be not alarmed at my entering your chamber tomorrow night at 12 o'clock. I shall then conduct you to an old friend, who will convince you that you are indeed my daughter. Yes, beloved Fanny, you have found a father in the man who now uses the name of Hamilton."
"Merciful heaven!" exclaimed Fanny, lifting up her hands and dropping the note which had excited such emotion in her heart. "Can it be that I have found a parent? All powerful nature, it was thy voice that spoke within me when first I beheld the author of my being. It was thy power that called forth my affection with such irresistible force, and bid me love before I knew my father. Alas, how shall I bear the agitation that now harrows up my feelings for so many hours as those that must intervene before the time appointed for our meeting?" Full of emotions such as these, poor Fanny paced up and down her chamber, forgetful of the waning night, and incapable of calming her perturbed imagination. Sometimes she felt such an ecstasy of joy that she could scarcely flatter herself the picture her fancy drew of the happiness awaiting her could really be a true one. A doubt would then obtrude itself that perhaps this was some artifice to ensnare her, and she recollected with dismay that Mr. Hamilton was a total stranger to her, and that whatever might be the instinctive affection she had felt for him, she had yet no certain proof that he was worthy of the confidence she must repose in him, when she was called upon to commit herself to his guidance at the dead hour of the night, and suffer him to lead her to some sequestered spot, impervious to the knowledge even of those who inhabited the same house. These were appalling reflections. Yet could they not subdue the impulse she felt to obey the summons, and learn her origin from the lips of a soi-disant parent. After several hours spent in the most painful agitation, her wearied frame seemed ready to sink under the combined powers of emotion and fatigue, and unable any longer to bear up against their force, Fanny threw herself, dressed as she was, upon her bed. A deep slumber soon sealed her senses, and she awoke not until the sun had been some time risen. Her first thought, on starting from her bed, was to look for Mr. Hamilton's note, which she recollected she had dropped from her hand in the first moments of her astonishment at reading its mysterious contents. She wished to re-peruse it, as she remembered the peculiar manner in which the note concluded, where her father said he now used the name of Hamilton, implying that it was not the one that properly belonged to him. What Colonel Ross had said of his pretending to be a gentleman, and his former assertion that he remembered his being tried for swindling, recurred to her remembrance, and helped to increase her perplexity. As she sought for the note, her eagerness to re-peruse it increased. What, then, was her consternation and dismay, when, having spent about half an hour in the search, she was obliged to yield to the conviction that the paper was nowhere to be found. At first her terror was excessive, as the loss was as unaccountable as it was unfortunate. That the note had been conveyed out of her room during her sleep was evident, but by whom was a point it was impossible to determine. And whoever was in possession of that paper was master of the secret it contained. When, however, Fanny reflected that the note had been placed upon her table by an invisible hand, she concluded that the same person had resumed it whilst her sleep had enabled them to do so unperceived. It was, however, an unpleasant circumstance to be at the mercy of a being who could enter her chamber at any hour they pleased, and even without her knowledge. She now recalled to mind the circumstance that occurred the first time she spent the holidays at Pemberton Abbey, when she had been awakened in the night by the appearance of her Mama Sidney at her bedside. The pains that had been taken to convince her that the apparition was the creature of her own imagination, or the effect of a dream, had never been able to eradicate the impression it had made upon her mind, and she still retained the most perfect remembrance of the circumstance. She recollected, too, the mysterious way in which the visitor disappeared, and the pains Lady Ellencourt had been at to ascertain whether or no there was any private entrance to the apartment Fanny slept in. The result of the investigation had been a conviction that there was no such thing, and that there was no communication from that room but through the door that led to Lady Ellencourt's apartment. The recent occurrence of the note having been placed upon her table, and afterwards removed by the same invisible hand, proved the fallacy of Lady Ellencourt's researches, and she now felt convinced that her infantine ideas, respecting Pemberton Abbey being the place of her earliest residence, were perfectly correct. These reflections strengthened her reliance upon her newfound parent, which was to reveal the secret of her birth, hitherto so darkly enveloped in mystery. The hour of breakfast now approached, and Fanny repaired to the toilette to arrange her dress, and to remove, as much as possible, the traces of emotion and trouble which had been impressed upon her countenance. She succeeded tolerably well, and descended to the breakfast parlour with a face dressed in smiles. Lady Maria was already there, and as soon as Fanny entered she called out with a good-humoured laugh, "Great news! Important news in the London Gazette!"
"What news, dear Lady Maria?" asked Fanny eagerly.
"Miss Stanhope is married, and the town talks of nothing else." Fanny's countenance fell instantly as Lady Maria finished the sentence.
"She is no longer Miss Stanhope, then," said she, "but the Duchess of Albemarle."
"Oh, no," answered Lady Maria, "you are not at all in the secret. Amelia is married, but not to the Duke, and there is the mighty wonder of the story." Lady Maria then read, from the newspaper she held in her hand, the chief of those circumstances that have already been related respecting Amelia's coup de main. The artifice of substituting deeds drawn in Sir Everard Mornington's name for the marriage articles, instead of those that had been drawn up for the Duke, was particularly dwelt upon by the newspaper wits, who styled Lady Mornington Napoleon in petticoats. Fanny felt comparatively indifferent to any of the particulars but those which spoke of the rupture of the contract between Amelia and the Duke. That news was doubly welcome now, as her imagination had already been expatiating in the field of probability, and fondly fancying that when her birth was ascertained, it might be found such as did not preclude the possibility of the union her heart was most inclined to wish for. of Amelia's partiality for Sir Everard Mornington, Fanny had long been convinced, and she rejoiced at her friend's ingenuity, had supplied her with the means of so dexterously substituting the man she did like for the one for whom she had always expressed the most decided aversion. The means had indeed been such as Fanny could not have adverted to, but the contrast in the dispositions of herself and her friend was striking in almost every other particular, and therefore it was not surprising that they differed in this. When Colonel Ross came in to breakfast, he said,
"Are there any letters this morning?"
"Oh, dear," replied Lady Maria, "I declare I was so taken up with the newspaper that I forgot the letters. Here are several," added she, "and amongst them two for you, Fanny." When Fanny took the letters into her hand, she recognized the writing of her beloved Lady Ellencourt on the superscription of the first she looked at. An exclamation of joy burst from her lips at the welcome sight, and she retired to one of the windows to peruse her treasure. What was her rapture, then, on reading the following words?
"I know you will rejoice, my beloved Fanny, to hear that we shall soon embrace you. We have taken our passage on board a ship of war, and are waiting for a convoy. We shall therefore, in all probability, soon follow this letter. The distracted state of this country renders a longer residence here extremely dangerous. You may therefore depend upon soon seeing us." Fanny could read no farther, but running up to Lady Maria, she put the letter into her hands and then burst into tears.
"What is the matter, my dear?" said Lady Maria, in a tone of alarm.
"Nothing but joy," replied Fanny, smiling through her tears. "My best friends are returning. I shall embrace them once more. I think all happiness comes together."
As Fanny pronounced the last words, Colonel Ross cast a penetrating glance towards her that confused her.
"Have you any other great cause for rejoicing?" said he. "I hope you rest your dependence upon sure grounds."
Fanny made no reply, but opening her other letter, she pretended to be deeply engaged with that. It was from Lady Mornington, and written in her accustomed style of giddiness. After recounting the particulars of her manoeuvres, which are already known, she wrote as follows:
"What does my dear Fanny think of my skill as a general? Should you not suppose that I had studied under the auspices of the little Corsican? Indeed, I am inclined to think I surpass him in finesse. And in stage effect, my drama is unrivalled. I always told you I meant to dramatize Lady Heron's song, and so I have, you see. Sir Everard made an excellent young Lochinvar, and carried me off in the true style of romance. A barouche was substituted for the steed, and that was rather an improvement, as I should not have very well relished the being jumbled on the crupper of a horse, like Fair Ellen of Netherby, though I felt quite as much inclined to play the heroine as she could. And I must tell you who played their part to the life, too. Your friend the Duke of Albemarle was quite at home in the character of the poor craven bridegroom, for he literally said never a word. And although he could not stand dangling his bonnet and plume, because he had not got one, he found as excellent a substitute in his watch, for which he took out 10 times in a minute, and consulted with as much gravity as if he was feeling the pulses of all the company. I believe if anybody could have done that kind office slyly, they would have found some symptoms of fever in 2 or 3 of the bridal throng. Poor Lord Summertown, in particular. I really thought the old fellow would have beaten me. You never saw such a turkey-cock in your life as he looked, when I made my daring declaration. And the good
Bishop, too, he was preciously angry, and read me such a lecture upon levity as would have done me good at any other time. But you know, the preaching prudence to a person who has just married against her friend's consent is like a physician prescribing for a dead patient. I dare say my poor Albemarle had a sound drubbing when his old uncle got the child home. By the way, I think the Duke carries his ideas of subordination a little too far, for he is as much afraid of offending Lord Summertown as any schoolboy of his pedagogue. I hope when you have him, you will teach him to be a little more independent. But Tameless is unfortunately your failing as well as your lover's, and so I am afraid you will make but a spiritless couple. I believe we must take compassion upon you, and give you a few lessons in the science of independence. Sir Everard and I are going to write a book in concert, and the title is to be Nature Reversed, or The Spirit of England. By this treatise we intend to emancipate the minds of our readers from the silly trammels of prejudice and custom, and show that children ought to command their parents, tutors, guardians, and, etc., servants their masters, and wives their husbands. Nay, even the brute tribe will find their advantage in this benevolent publication, as it will teach a valuable method of training rats. A certain young nobleman, it is said, has made this valuable discovery, that rats fed upon live kittens and milk are a match at close fighting for the stoutest cat that can be found. To kill cats, and thereby deliver that injured part of the creation from the persecution they have hitherto groaned under. Don't you long to read our learned labor? But, my dear, it will take so long composing, revising, and correcting, that you must wait longer than I fear you will like. But, however, you shall not remain uninstructed all that tedious period. We intend passing the honeymoon at this place, namely, Mornington Park in Lancashire, and in our way from hence to London, we design to favour you with a visit en passant. And then we shall see what we can make of you. I make no doubt you will receive a visit from the Duke of Albemarle long before that time. If you should, pray don't forget to tell him, with my compliments, that I never saw him look so animated as when he blessed me and thanked me at parting for running away from him. Adieu. Thus concluded this giddy epistle, and Fanny could not forbear laughing at her lively friend, although her heart did not entirely acquit her of the levity attributed to her conduct by the worthy prelate who had lectured her. End of chapter 26.